Romans chapter 12. We have been in the 12th chapter of the book of Romans for a while now, observing the applications or the injunctions or the imperatives that the Apostle Paul gives to the Christians in Rome in the light of a pending visit that he was to undertake to them. And at the same time, it is in the light of the truths of the gospel that he had opened up before them all the way from chapter 1 to chapter 11. And as we commence chapter 12, I trust you were able to see, first of all, the overarching principle, which we'll come back to again and again and again. And it is this, chapter 12. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, or in view of the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. That's the overarching principle. It's the basis on which we come to live out the Christian life. It is not so much that I want to do good so that I may impress God and therefore God may welcome me into his presence. Rather, it is that I want to do good because God has done good to me. I want to love him because he has loved me. In other words, love responds to love. It reciprocates that which it receives. We also went on to see from there that there is need, therefore, for a major mind shift if we are to truly live the Christian life. The Apostle Paul refers to it as stopping to be conformed to the world and instead starting to be transformed in the renewing of our minds. And again, it's something that we will see over and over again, because in the section where we are being told a lot of things that we ought to be doing that make up the Christian life. And the truth is that that's not natural. The environment in which we are, in fact, militates against that. It points in the opposite direction. That's the way the world thinks. And it is crucial, if we are going to live the Christian life, to think biblically instead of just thinking. Deliberately force your mind to ask the question, what does the Bible say? And then, if this is what it says, then I ought to fight hard to do it. We saw that the first area of application was in the context of the church. That was from verse 3 down to verse 8. And it had a lot to do with a famous concept of the Apostle Paul, where he visualizes the church as a body. He uses the picture of the human body. And so hands and feet and eyes and nose and ears and so on are meant to represent Christians with different gifts, each one acknowledging that these are the gifts God has given me, and because they are given me, I cannot be proud. In fact, it's my responsibility to ensure that I live out my life in a way that is commensurate with the gifts that he has given me. So we've already seen that. Having gifts, verse 6, that differ according to the grace given to us, let us use them. That's the simple point. He gives a few examples there, but the main point is we've received these gifts. Let's put them to use so that God might be glorified in his church. The section that we began looking at together is verse 9 downwards. It is the most concentrated passage of Scripture in terms of the number of injunctions or imperatives that the Apostle Paul gives to us as believers. It's literally one after the other. in quick succession, you'd think that the Apostle Paul is using an automatic weapon to fire away at us, because it's literally in two or three phrases and is moving on one to the other. We are looking at verse 9, which in fact has occupied us already for 2 weeks, and we're now wrapping it up today, where the Apostle Paul says, "Let love be genuine, abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good." And what we saw there is the fact that the Apostle Paul is seeking to bring out the major bouncing board of everything that is there in our Christian lives. And ultimately, it is love. It is love. And when we look at this passage, we noticed that Paul was not primarily saying, make sure that your love is genuine. He's simply saying that love is genuine. In fact, you can't have it any other way. The moment I'm doing you good, but I have another motive that finally comes back to myself, it's not really love for you anymore. It's love for myself, or love for my name, or love for whatever. Love is genuine by nature. It's genuine. It's about you and me seeking to do you good. But it is out of that that the Apostle Paul then gives two statements. One is a negative and one is a positive. And it's easy for us to understand it if we think of love as energy, as a kind of combustion chamber that makes us do something. And I used an example before. If a baby was to cry in the background, and we have quite a number of mothers here, the mother would pick out that must be my child, and there would be nothing like any debate in the mother's mind. The mother would immediately rise and dress to go and deal with whatever the situation might be. That's the way true love is. It energizes. It makes you do something. But what we are learning here is that Christian love is moral by its very nature. It's moral. It's one that energizes you to do negative things towards what is evil and to do positive things to that which is good. And that's what we are seeing in this text. So we'll still allow the ESV to win the day. So we'll still say, let love be genuine. But our interest is in that second part. Abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. Now, last time we dealt with abhor what is evil or hate what is evil. I'll come back to it as we continue to the third and last section of this verse. Hold fast to what is good. In other words, genuine Christian love is moral love. It doesn't just abhor that which is evil, it also hangs on tenaciously to that which is good. And it's important for us, as we are thinking in terms of our spiritual well-being, our spiritual stature, our spiritual maturity, to use this as a kind of mirror to see how we are doing as we are seeking to live out the Christian life. Let's quickly then look at this third injunction, that we are to hold fast to what is good. Basically, the phrase hold fast is simply one word in the Greek, and the King James Version uses the word cleave, and the New King James Version uses the word cling. And in many ways, both of those phrases are actually correct. The Greek word that is used there has to do with gluing together, cementing together, or joining together. I have two quick verses that I want us to see. And the first is Matthew 19, which best illustrates what we're talking about. And then I'll also use Luke chapter 10, which is not the best of examples, but at least I need to be faithful to you in showing you where the root of this word is used. Matthew 19 and verse 5. Let me begin from verse 4. Jesus answered, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And he said, therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother," and here is the phrase, "hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." In other words, there will be a lot in any marriage, and all of you who are married will know this, that will seek to tear you apart from your spouse. Your own personality, your spouse's personality, issues of economics, relatives all around putting their pressure, hey, this one is not giving us babies, you know, part with her and so on and so forth. All kinds of pressures. What you do is you cleave, you cling on, so that despite all the social pressures that are there, you still remain married. You still cling on to your spouse. You've left parent, and you literally glue yourselves together so that whatever the winds might be blowing, you still remain one. And the Lord here is saying that was God's intention. That's the way he planned marriage. It was to be something that would survive the storms, the pulling and the pushing, so that ultimately you remain together. Another place where it is used is Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10, I like it. It's a bit of a weak example, but I like it because it's a picture that those of us who are in Africa will be better able to identify with. Luke chapter 10 and verse 11. Let's begin a verse or two above. Verse 10. "But whenever you enter a town and they do not receive you," notice they don't receive you, "go into its streets and say, even the dust of your town that clings to our feet, we wipe off against you." The dust of your town that clings to our feet, we wipe off against you. There was a time I needed to buy a pair of shoes, and the person who was helping me kept trying to convince me to buy a black shoe. And I kept saying, no, I should buy a brown one. And you couldn't understand because the black shoe was much, much better. I said to him, yeah, where you are, dust is not a problem. Where I live, by mid-morning, anybody will be looking at my shoes wondering where I've been. So I prefer a brown one because it hides the dust. Here, dust clings. And often, when people are going to church, you see them as they're about to enter the church premises. They put their shoes on top of a rock and start cleaning to remove the dust. Because that dust just won't go away on its own. You can do this if you please. You will carry it with you in church. And so they remove the dust which clings on. It's exactly the picture that the Apostle Paul is using here. This hanging on, cleaving, clinging tenaciously despite the effort being made. And so in this particular case, he is saying, we will wipe, we will deliberately use force, the force of a cloth, in order to remove the dust. Now, how are we to apply this? I think it's important for us to appreciate that what Paul was saying here when he said, abhor what is evil and hold fast to what is good, is an allusion to Amos chapter 5 and verse 15. So just quickly turn with me to Amos chapter 5 and verse 15. And I want you to see, I'll be patient with you. It's the minor prophets. As long as I'm still hearing that nice sound, I'll be patient. Chapter 5 and verse 15. Maybe let me begin with verse 14 because I want you to notice the deliberate contrasting. It says there, verse 14, all right, I think we are there, unless you are pretending. Seek good and not evil. Okay, so pursue good, don't pursue evil, that you may live. And so the Lord, the God of hosts, will be with you, as you have said. And here it is now. Hate evil and love good, and establish justice in the gate. It may be that the Lord, the God of hosts, will be gracious to the remnant of Joseph. Now, when you read this passage in the Old Testament, it soon becomes clear that actually Amos is not referring to two separate activities. No, sort of saying, okay, you know, when you face evil, hate it. And then sometimes when you face good, love it. He's referring to the energy that is within you. And that energy is one that invariably responds to situations this way. So the same energy, the moment it is faced with evil, there is a sense of disgust and abhorrence. And there is no needing to change gears and do anything else. The moment it is good, it is faced with, there is an attraction, an immediate desire, a wanting to cling on with everything in me for that which is good. That's essentially what he's saying. So, in this particular case, especially when we get back to Amos, he says, hate evil and love good and establish justice in the gate. In other words, it's what the gate is, a sign of the place where the elders of a city used to dwell together in order to process different cases that were being brought to them. So what he's basically saying there is that if you're going to see justice done, you shouldn't be indifferent. As you are sitting there and it soon becomes evident that this person has been malicious, already righteous indignation ought to be coming out of you so that the wrong is dealt with. The moment good is coming towards you, the same thing in you ought to rise that is overwhelmed with gratitude and love and attraction and so on. Now, if you are like that, justice is going to be established. If you are not like that, and you have to be thinking and changing batteries and thinking again, you can be sure when a bit of currency passes under the table, that's it. Justice won't happen because there isn't this emotion, this energy that is rising within you. So we go back to our text then. That's where Paul has, as it were, picked this saying. And consequently, it's very clear that he is juxtapositioning the negative emotion and negative energy with the positive emotion and positive energy. Now, brethren, I think this is important. Because when I was speaking last time, I was speaking about abhorring evil. And I really emphasized that if we are truly godly, we must hate sin. We must abhor evil. It must be, even at an emotional level, it must, the energy must be oozing out in order to condemn and correct that which is evil and wrong and sinful. However, there are a lot of people who claim to be Christians, and they could be, who condemn what is wrong, but are inactive about what is right. Condemning what is evil, but they stop there. There is no moral energy for that which is right. In other words, they will say a lot of things, for instance, against abortion. They will. But there will be no energy about preserving life. Actively preserving life. Seeking to ensure that there's wholesomeness and joy and peace in God's world. There is no energy there except pointing fingers and pointing fingers and pointing fingers at that which is wrong. That's not the apostles' Christianity here. It is like the Good Samaritan who is making his way from Jericho and then sort of stops somewhere and he sees the priest pass and doesn't help. And then he sees the Levite also pass, that man who was robbed and left half dead, and also doesn't help. And all he does is to make his way into Jerusalem and go and start saying, these priests are useless. These Levites. No, man. They're all just hypocrites. Ba, 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 saying a lot of things. And then he say, but what did you yourself do? Because the man was bleeding there. What did you do? Now, you can't spend all your energy criticizing others when you are not yourself willing to go with your camel there, pick up the person who's half dead, take him to the hospital, and ensure that the appropriate people attend to him, pay some money, and so on and so forth. Now, that's what goodness is. It must be energy in both. And sadly, brethren, those of us, and I put myself in that category, who are reformed, one of our major weaknesses is that we are very good at correcting, doctrinally and practically. Very good, because we know our Bibles. So when we see error, it's like a hound, you know those dogs that are trained to smell for blood. When we just see a little bit of error, we come alive. I mean, alive. But when, you know, there are real positive issues, evangelism, prayer, missions, financial giving. Yeah. Now, this passage is saying, where true love is, it's both. It's the same love that has the energy that precipitates. So the moment it's evil, it is seeing, it abhors. The moment there is the opportunity for good, it is exactly the same tenacity and energy to cling on to this. Now, that is biblical Christianity. That's biblical Christianity. We shouldn't just abhor, we should hold fast. But then hold fast to what? The Bible here says, abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. What is good? Agathos, what is good? Again, we must ask ourselves the question, what is it that the Bible has in mind here when it refers to that which is good? Thankfully, it's a contrast. In other words, we are dealing with the opposite. Evil and good. Even in 1 Peter chapter 3, if we can just quickly go there. 1 Peter chapter 3, I think about verse 11, you find again this juxtapositioning of the two, contrasting the two. I begin from verse 10. For whoever desires to love life and see good days, let him, notice the negatives now, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. And here it is now, the turn. Let him turn away from evil and do good. There it is. And then he continues with the good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. So again, you notice how the two are being held in the opposite. What is the good? It is the opposite of the evil. That shouldn't be difficult. So then, how do we know? How do we define what is good? We can do so by defining what is evil. And that's why I said it's a moral issue. And how do we know what is evil? It is that which goes against the law of God. The law of God. And I can easily prove it to you. Let's go to Exodus 20, which gives us a summary of the Ten Commandments. A summary of the Ten Commandments. And what I want you to notice is that the Ten Commandments are largely given in the negative. So it is, do not, do not, do not, do not, do not. Now that's saying, this is evil, this is evil, this is evil, this is evil. Now you make a big mistake when you think that the Ten Commandments are negative. They're not. They are phrased at an extreme end, almost the way in which when you are using a catapult, you pull this way in order to let go, and you are actually throwing into the positive. That's what is here. So when it says, for instance, in verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. That's the evil, having other gods other than Jehovah himself. That's the evil. What is the evil? Idolatry. What is the good? The true worship of God alone. Giving all my heart and mind and soul and strength to God. That's the good. So if you're asking me what the good is, there is already an example. It is that I will want with everything in me to worship only God. I'm going to persevere. I'm going to strain every sinew while the world is pulling me here and the world is pulling me there and wanting to multiply my gods. I am persevering tenaciously, wanting to have the altar of my heart to be occupied by God alone, so that He is the one I truly worship. Then I am clinging on to that which is good. Let me quickly give you a second one. And it will still be in the first tablet. And it is, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. And that has to do with the means of worship. He is saying, God is the one who Himself has determined how He is to be worshipped. You are not to try and represent Him into something and then begin to worship Him through that thing. No. He has determined how He's to be worshipped, and you are to worship Him thus. So what is the evil? It is bringing into God's worship that which He has not ordained. That's the evil. It is being innovative in worship. You go somewhere else and you find that this is the way they are worshiping, and you know, that's the reason why Islam has become so popular. It's because, you know, they do this, therefore, now let's also bring it to Christianity. That's the evil. You are invading an area where God has absolute prerogative. This is who I am. This is how I want you to worship me. Well, how do you do it? It is by you deliberately pursuing, tenaciously fighting to worship God the way He seeks to be worshipped. In the elements of worship that He Himself has prescribed. And that's not even saying that therefore it must be singing and therefore you're singing. Because I can assure you there are many times I'm standing there, I'm singing, and my brain keeps going back to my sermon. And I have to keep saying, no! Right now, it's about the words that are there, and I ought to be joining with the saints in order to speak those words to my God. He's worthy of worship. And therefore, the song is a means by which I am giving Him worship. Or similarly, you've had a hard day, the day before, maybe you've studied all night, and you are dozing. You can be in church. And the sermon is going on, and you are sort of going on. You are going on. You are going on. Persevere tenaciously. Do something about it. This is good. Being in church, listening to God's word preached is good. Therefore, I'm going to do everything possible to make sure that I'm listening. I'm bringing it in, all in. God, speak to me, speak to me, speak to me, that I may know how I ought to live out there for your glory. So all that which is fighting to take away the word from my mind, I'm fighting it out because I want to cling to that which is good. So I can continue going. The point I want you to see is that it's not, you know, sort of finding a beggar at Manda Hill traffic lights, and I sort of bring down my window a little bit and push out a one kwacha and I've done good. That's not the point. It's a lot more glorious than that. It's holistic. Let's come down to the other tablet. And again, I'll just illustrate it with two examples. You shall not murder. Again, that's the negative. It is in terms of evil. Don't do this. Hate this. The deprivation of life. Hate it. Abhor it. Anyone who is doing anything that endangers human life in any way or form, the whole of you ought to rise, to do something about it. Well, the opposite is equally true. It is the opposite. The effort being made deliberately to preserve life, to preserve human life. Do something about it. So, I'll give you an obvious example. I hope you won't all fall over each other to get to UTH blood bank. But, you know, there's no blood at UTH. And there are so many churches around. Come on, guys. Eh? You do something about it. Unless you are a recent convert from Jehovah's Witness. You do something about it. You're active. There's been a major accident. And there's need for blood. You rush there. You are deliberately doing something in order to preserve life. Doing good. One final example is you shall not commit adultery. Again, we know the evil. Sexual immorality. It's the evil. Adultery. Fornication, promiscuity, and so on. We can throw into it pornography and every form of sexual perversion, homosexuality, transgender. I don't know what else now they will invent. Chakuti, chakuti, nda. Throw it all in. You don't just sit there saying, well, you know, some people. You know, others anyway? No! God preserves the area of sexuality according to his law. Perversion of it is something you abhor. Well, the opposite is equally true. That I deliberately love the institution of marriage. I preserve the purity of the marriage bed. I deliberately do everything possible in my own heart as well to ensure purity in this area. I'm doing everything possible that I may be as holy as possible in that area too. Are you seeing the point here? So when Paul is saying, hold fast to what is good, it is whatever is good. Whatever is good. I'm quite impressed with the Westminster Divines, but that's by the way I'm referring to people in the Puritan era, with the way in which they were very deliberate in making us appreciate both the negative and positive of the Ten Commandments. Here is a typical example to do with the sixth and seventh commandment. I'll deliberately go to the seventh one, which I ended up with. It says this, the seventh commandment is this, you shall not commit adultery. Then it says, what are the duties required in the seventh commandment? Listen to this. The duties required in the seventh commandment are chastity in body, mind, and affections, and words, and behavior, and the preservation of it in ourselves and others, watchfulness over the eyes and all the senses, temperance, keeping of chaste company, modesty in apparel. In other words, modest dressing, sisters. Marriage by those that have not the gift of continence. Conjugal love and cohabitation. In other words, if I'm married, I stay with my husband or my wife. Diligent labor in our calling. In other words, I'm providing for my marriage. Shunning all occasions of uncleanness and resisting temptations therefore. Have you noticed how positive it is? Eh? The heaven said, what does it forbid? Don't commit adultery. No. They begin with the positive. The positive. And then they now go to the negative. What are the sins forbidden in the seventh commandment? The sins forbidden in the seventh commandment, besides the neglect of the duties required, which is where he has come from, or they've come from, they now say, are adultery, fornication, rape, incest, sodomy, and all unnatural lusts, where you can fit in all these, the things I mentioned earlier. All unclean imaginations, thoughts, purposes, and affections. All corrupt and filthy communications. Or listening, therefore. Wanton looks. In other words, where you are sort of looking a lot at the lady or something. Impudent or light behavior. In other words, you're cracking jokes about sexual things wrongly. Again, they repeat, immodest apparel. Prohibiting of lawful and dispensing with unlawful marriages. Allowing, tolerating, keeping of stews and resorting to them. Entangling vows of single life. In other words, where you start vowing, no, I'll be single for the rest of my life. You are sinning. Sort it out. There are a few more, but I love this one. Undue delay of marriage. Undue delay. Taking too long to marry. You are sinning. Okay, clearly we can laugh. But the point that is being made is this. The effort. That's the thing I'm trying to say. The effort. Abhorring that which is wrong. But there is equally effort in the opposite direction. A lot of effort. And brethren, the reason why this effort in the opposite direction, in the positive direction is necessary, is because of the reality of the opposite. Remember what I said, that it's not two different emotions, one this way, one this side. It's the same energy that's coming through. And that same energy that wants to live for God is being pulled backwards by evil. So if you don't, as it were, kick against this, it continues to pull you back. You ought to equally exert energy to push forward, to love that which is right and good, if you are going to have a mature, growing Christian life. Now let me quickly wrap it up this way. I mentioned this last time, so I'll quickly rush through it. You can see from this that therefore Christianity or Christian love is not mere sentimentality. It's not. It's not sort of taking a philometer and simply putting it in your heart and sort of feeling, am I enjoying this or not? It's first of all, intensity. Real intensity. I mean, the phrase abhor suggests intensity. The word hold fast, cleave onto, cling, also suggests intensity. illustration comes to mind. It is in my notes. Of a day I was watching football with somebody who's in here, so I don't want to embarrass them. And the person had to leave to go and do something else, so I was asked to sort of just keep a watch on what's happening. So when the person came back, he asked me, has anyone scored? My answer was, yeah, one of these guys wearing red scored. The person's comment was, I can give half the world to watch football like you. Because to me, it didn't really matter who won the game. So the red guy scored, the other guys. And sadly, many of us are like that to Christianity. It's okay, those people, that's the way they like this, so this, that's what they like. There's no sense of attachment. Now, I do sometimes watch football with real soccer fans. You'd think the world hangs on who wins. The intensity. Yeah. This guy misses the goal. They even call him names. Eh? This coach should get this guy. There's, you know, we would die from a heart attack if this guy wanted to play like this. There is intensity. And you should see when their team puts in a few more goals and the game is over. It's like Jesus Christ has come back. Now, it bothers me, brethren, that a mere sport should have that level of intensity from Christians. And I'm not castigating anybody there. But what I'm saying is the opposite. That when we now come to moral issues, we are ambivalent. We are. We are willing to just play with anybody, doesn't matter how they live and so on. After all, it's them, it's not me. You know, it's going to be judgmental and everything else. Now, how come you were judgmental when this guy failed to score? You wanted him out. You even started shouting at the coach as if he can hear you behind the screen of the TV. Hey, whatever the coach's name is, get that chap out. And there's no eternity at stake. Zero. And here are matters where individual are sinning against Almighty God. They are ruining their souls. They are ruining other people's souls. They are dragging others into hell. They are pouring a fortune to promote that which is ugly and sinful and evil and wicked in the eyes of God. And guess what? We Christians will not even take up pen and paper to write to the editor and say, this is wrong. We won't. We won't. We won't. Or better still, to deliberately do something to promote that which is right. We won't. It bothers me. Because then where is love? Where is love? Where is Christian love? Where? The Apostle Paul here is saying, abhor what is evil, hold fast, cling on to that which is good. Let love burst the banks, as it were, in order to promote that which God's law says should be happening. Christianity is not just intense, but Christianity is full of activity. And we will soon come to see it here. When he speaks about love one another with brotherly love, he goes on to say, outdo one another in showing honor. Outdo, not outthink, outdo one another. He goes on to say, do not be slothful in zeal, be fervent in spirit, serve the Lord. That's Christianity. And brethren, where this energy is lacking, and our Christianity has been reduced to simply going to church on a Sunday, of course very late, drowsy throughout the whole thing, and then finally go home, you've ticked the box, it's all behind me, and whatever is happening in the world, even if the world is rotting, it's beside the point. After all, me, I'll get my salary at the month end and go on and on and on. Friends, that's not the Christianity of the Bible. Don't cheat yourself. The Christianity of the Bible fights moral fights. In the family, they despise you because of the fact that when you are there, you brook no nonsense over that which is evil and sinful and wicked. But more than that, they see a positive life in you, promoting that which is good and truthful and ethically upright. They see it in you, actively doing so. And in both cases, they hate you for it. In the office, exactly the same way. You can be trusted by your employers. They can trust you. They know you are passionate about faithfulness, passionate about truthfulness. It bothers you when you just have to change a figure a little bit. It bothers you because you want to be transparent. It's not just that you're condemning others. It is that you yourself want to uphold the best as far as excellence is concerned in being a custodian, a steward of God's world. They can trust you. But that's the very reason why they hate you. That's the reason why your fellow employees hate you. Because they can see why you're being promoted. They hate you. They think too chawa. They hate you. But yours is because of the change that is there. May I say the same in the Christian faith, in the Christian church? It bothers me, brethren, how many times as elders, by the time we are dealing with a particular sin in one person, we discover that so many other people in the church knew, and they were just playing with it. It bothers me. And it bothers me that a person can live in sin for so long and they don't deal with it themselves. Deal with it. Because your heart is supposed to be clinging on to that which is God, yourself. So that by the time anything is coming up, you're able to say, yes, that was a struggle I had 5 years ago. But I fought, I kicked, I screamed, I pleaded with God, and he saw me out of this. And I've been persevering in that which is good since then. That's Christianity. Oh, that God might produce this kind of love in us. that people may see in us what we'll be singing in the next song. I hope it's still going to be shown. Okay. An individual who is continuing to go up and up and up and up. Not just hating other people's sins, but hating his own sin. And loving the heights of godliness that God has given us and pursuing it higher and higher and higher. May God produce that kind of Christianity in us. Amen.